I know that we're onto something because I'm sweating. I can tell you that right off the bat, that my hands are just absolutely soaked and freezing.
If I was filming this, you'd just see Barbara just drenched in sweat right now. It would just be pouring out of her.
It's a sweatband.
Yeah.
This is a sport.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about this podcast, go to the website lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be on that website. If you would like to drop Patrick a line, you can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a voicemail message up to 3 minutes in length. If you look down in the description of this episode, you will see a link to the website and everything else you need to know about this project as well. Here's the episode.
Hello, friends. I'm going to keep this introduction extremely short. I am not going to try to put anything in each of your minds before we jump into this, except to provide the basic information about each of these individuals that I interviewed for this thing, Barbara Cecil and Dar Jamail. As you know, anybody that's listened to this podcast knows that I've interviewed Dar quite a few times. I think this might be our fifth interview that we've done, and this is my first time speaking to Barbara for the podcast. Now, Barbara and Dar are very good, very close friends, and I've gotten to know them over the past several weeks as of the recording of this interview and of this introduction. So the dynamic in this interview is very real. I don't know how else to say it. We really get to the heart of it, and I'm just gonna try to not say anything more about it. I just want to say one thing, which is that this is probably one of the best interviews or discussions that I've ever recorded for this podcast. I say that with humility. It's the most real thing that I think I've recorded for this. And I want to just provide some very basic information for each of these incredible individuals I had the chance to speak with for this interview. Barbara is the author of Coming Into Your Own, A Woman's Guide Through Life Transitions. You can learn more about Barbara and her work at endingsandbeginnings.com. Find a link to that down in the description. And also, you can find a link to Dar Jamail's website, darjamail.net, down there as well as a link to his book, The End of Ice, Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. Also, I'll be providing a link to their series published through Truthout titled, How Then Shall We Live? So without any further delay, I just want to get right into this thing. Please enjoy this discussion with Barbara Cecil and Dar Jamail.
First, I just want to thank both of you for being with me. I've been up here for a couple weeks. I've gotten to know Barbara quite a bit, and of course, Dar. Your generosity has been incredible. So I just first want to just sit here in gratitude for having the opportunity to sit with both of you and have this interview. So thank you both for allowing me to inhabit your space. Thank you. Yeah. So obviously, you know, Dar, this is our fifth interview that we've done. You're definitely at the top next to maybe one other person that I've had on the podcast. So I was thinking about that. It's kind of funny, but you know, you and I have developed a relationship, so it's kind of made sense to keep on doing these kind of updates with the podcast and talking about it. And we've swung back and forth with interviews where we're talking more about the data of climate change, climate disruption, and then going back to kind of how do we be in this time, the awareness, the grief that comes up with all that comes in when you start to really take in the science of it. And so the last interview we did was only a couple months ago. And in that, we did discuss more of the data, I think. So this is appropriate. We're swinging back to the other side. And of course, now we have Barbara. And this is your first time on the podcast. So I think we're going to just have a really good group dynamic here, group discussion. I know both of you have collaborated quite a bit. You have a series that you've been doing together for Truthout, the How Then Shall We Live series, right? And I think what I want to start with, you know, with Dar first, because you, I think this has been a year, at least for me, of transitions. And of course, Barbara, you're kind of an expert, if you could say that, in transitions, life transitions. But Dar, if you wanted to comment in whatever amount of detail you feel comfortable in, talking about some of the transitions that you've at least experienced with your work in journalism, Maybe other personal experiences. I think that would set the tone for the interview, at least, I think. Yeah.
Thanks, Patrick. And I'll just add, it's been lovely having you here, and really you feel like family, and it's just been a real joy and very settling experience. And it's great. I'm grateful that what started as a lone interview on your podcast has turned into not just a good, strong series of production of work, but a friendship, you know? So, and I'll also preface this on a lighter note that, Barbara's dog Koa is sitting right here. So if people maybe hear a little heavy breathing in the background, it's just our little emotional support dog going here. Koa is snoring. So. Yeah.
Well, I want to say last time we spoke in person in January, there was a support dog present then.
Oh, okay.
Rob's dog Sage was with us in the interview too. So
that's the theme.
It's the theme.
We can't do in-person interviews without emotional support dog.
We need
dog.
A cute animal to keep it, keep it in focus.
Keep it real.
Keep it centered.
That's right. Okay.
Anyway.
So changing the tone dramatically on a dime, then I'll just say that, I've been working as a journalist for 16 years. I got into it by passionately, with reckless abandon, throwing myself into the Iraq occupation and reported on that for a long time. And then I have been on the climate beat now for a solid 9 years. And for a long time, I've really just felt done and felt like there's really, I've covered this from so many different angles. And what I realized was, well, I'll back up by just contextualizing it with what happened to me in Iraq and why I knew it was time for me to leave my coverage of that was I'd covered it so extensively from every imaginable angle and then started noticing that I was basically doing the same stories over and over. And the only thing that was changing was adjusting upwards the body counts. And that takes an emotional toll, as well as just feeling like, well, that my contribution's done. I've covered it from every way that I know that I can and repeatedly. And now it's time for me to do something else. And so I moved on. And plus, I always knew that the climate story was one that I really, really wanted to cover. And so I've had a similar experience with the climate beat where I feel like I've covered it from every possible angle that I can, to now culminating with all of that after 5 years of climate dispatches for Truth Out. And then, this book, The End of Ice, which Barbara edited, and, I just feel like everything that I have to offer to contribute to this topic is in the book. And the only way I could improve upon the book would be to go back in and basically like update some of the figures as time goes by. But it's a strong collection of work, and I don't have anything else to add. And so that's where I was coming into this time and knew that it was time for me to move on. As a journalist, I'm finished being a journalist. I just don't feel like I can contribute more in that way, and it's time for me to do something else. So that was already in motion, and I had actually given Truth Out 1 month notice a few weeks ago. And so as we speak, I'm officially finished as a journalist. I haven't, by the time this airs, it will be made public to our readers, but it hasn't been made so public yet while we're talking. And Barbara and I will continue our column, however, but I'm going into something else. And then right when this, literally the last week of my work as a journalist, my best friend of 23 years, Dwayne French, passed away. And I had the honor of actually sitting with him through that time. It was after a long battle with cancer, and then literally being by his bedside when he took his last breath. And both of these things happening, overlapping, so clearly I'm going through a huge, huge transition in my own life. And, that was a friendship of 23 years. It was a journalism career of 16 years. And so I've had a lot of direct, personal, visceral experience in loss and death and letting go. And it's extremely poignant, and I do not question the timing. And it's perfect practice for me in these times. And kind of my joke is, you know, when Barbara and I came up with the title of our column, I'm getting to really walk my talk, and I'm being forced to practice that now. And it's hard as hell. Because I mean, you've been here with me, and like, I have times when I just don't really want to get out of bed, and, you know, and have been in some pretty dark places at times inside, and it's all against the backdrop of the global apocalypse, of the climate apocalypse, of the political apocalypse, of all of this. It's just massive loss. It is the age of loss. And, so that's the context that I'm bringing in personally to this conversation today.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that. And Barbara, I think that this dynamic of transition on the personal level, whether it's endings like with death, or maybe the ending of a relationship, or the ending of a career, or, I mean, all the transitions that human beings inevitably go through, that's happening on the micro level, on the individual level. But there is something happening globally right now that is also asking us to accept endings. And in your perspective, how can we learn maybe from the personal side of this and then integrate that into a deeper understanding of what's happening to our biosphere?
I do a lot of coaching work with people who are in the process of changing and shifting from one thing to another at thresholds in their life. And that usually is triggered by an ending. And I like how you've described the parallel between a giant ending of capitalism, of the Western civilization. Mm-hmm. And what I notice is that in my mind, I read about all this. I know that that's going, you know, all going on. And I actually accept that, and sometimes I'm rather excited by that. And I know that it's right because of the seeds that were planted along the way, and this is inevitable. But I think the things that I feel most intensely are the endings that happen in close. Mm-hmm. And they all get melded into one thing. But what I'm noticing is that there are, like a couple years ago, I could not live in the town that I had lived in for 20 years. I needed to be on different ground. I could not explain it. There was a need for me at this stage of my life to connect to the earth. And that was not my earth. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of justification for leaving that had to do with smoke and fires in that area, climate-related things. But I, deeper down underneath, I knew I needed a new setting and a new place to have a real reciprocal, deep relationship with the earth. And that's how I got here to Port Townsend. Mm-hmm. So those, I think so many people are being moved to end things that no longer serve, that don't feel right, that were initiated on a wrong basis, that serves ego, that serves who we used to be and not who we're becoming. So there's the need to make changes, mm-hmm. whether they make sense or not. So I think part of my job is to be holding that perspective that there's a multi-level transition going on that will have deep personal impact, and that we need the ability to put our arms around it for what it is and listen underneath the chaos and the deep angst for actually what's trying to come through or to be born or to manifest in this particular time.
Okay. And Dara, I mean, when you talked about being at your friend's side as he's dying, you had a choice that you said to me earlier about. It's the choice that many people have when their loved one is dying and they have to make decisions, or the person, if they're able to make that decision themselves as they're dying, of whether they should do all this extremely intense procedures, surgeries, you know, whatever sort of treatments are thrown at them by the modern medical system to give them more time. And then the choice of living in it, it can be denial of what's happening. That's how it can manifest often. Even if it's just a few more days of life, people will go through incredible pain and stress and difficulty just to give that person just a few more days of life, regardless of the quality of those last days. You know, that's not even acknowledged or brought into the discussion. Because if you then bring that up of, well, what is this more time really going to bring to us? Is it going to be quality? Is it going to be serving that person ultimately through the transition into death? Or is it serving something else, right? So that was something you said that really struck me when you were talking about being there with him, is you had to make a decision for yourself. Like, am I going to be present, totally present with this person as they pass? And in that work that you've done for so long on the climate and seeing it for what it really is, what are those parallels there? If you wanted to speak on that, please.
Right. So what happened with my friend was he had stage 4 bladder cancer, and he went through chemo and knew it was going, if the chemo worked and they could go in and essentially remove the bladder and several other organs that were going to need to come out that had cancer, then it was going to require a reconstructive surgery. And, you know, and this is with a guy who's been he's been quadriplegic for 51 years, and he went into this surgery weighing 75 pounds. So this is a really big deal, right? But he is to call him a tenacious individual is to put it lightly. Like, I've seen this guy literally resurrect himself from the dead before. And so if any, you know, it seemed like a bleak prospect to begin with, but if anyone was going to make it through it, it was going to be him. And so he goes through it, and he goes through the surgery, and the surgery was successful. However, when they were in there, they found a whole new cancer that hadn't shown up on the scans, and was squamous cell, which was impervious to the chemo. So they sew him back up, and then they give us this news, and it's like, okay, well, you know, we're very concerned, but then the next step is he recovers from the surgery and then he goes home, and then we look at possible clinical trials or immunotherapy, et cetera, et cetera. Basically Hail Marys. Mm-hmm. Just start throwing Hail Marys at it. And then it comes down to, like, what you mentioned, a question of quality of life. And, but before it got to having to make those kinds of decisions, you know, Dwayne started not recovering from the surgery and had to wear a breathing mask for a while. And then literally a decision was made by him with myself and his partner and the doctor present, took off the breathing mask, which was essentially what was keeping him alive, although he was suffering mightily. And he said, no more mask, no more mask, you know. And we all knew exactly what that meant. And so then it was just make him comfortable and let's sit with him. And so that's what we started doing. And, you know, it was absolutely profound for me to just be there and be present for my friend, and then hit a point where, you know, the doctors, a lot of them say, well, he's gone now, he can't hear you, this is just his body, you know. But I knew that he could hear me, and I kept talking to him. And there were several things that happened that confirmed to me that without a doubt he heard me. And I kept telling him, it's okay, you're finished here, you've done everything you came to do, you can go anytime you want now, feel free to go, we're gonna be okay, you know. And I kept telling him that, and then when the time of his choosing came, and it was without a doubt to his choosing, he went. And in fact, I kept telling him, I should tell the whole story because it's pretty remarkable in that he, you know, it was, they had moved him up to another room, which was where it was essentially a transition room, and they're going to, for people going into hospice. And then we were hoping to get him home the next day so he could die in his own bed. And we got him up there, and then his partner, Kelly, her daughter and son-in-law were flying in, and I kept telling them, okay, we're getting you up to this room. Kelly's going to go get the kids, bring them up. All y'all are going to have some time together, and then they're going to take her home because we're all exhausted. I'm going to be with you until 9 p.m., at which time your other friend Sakum's going to come and sit with you through the night, and then tomorrow we're all going to be back up here, and we're going to get you home. And so I kept him abreast. They came up. They had their visit. They left. I updated him. Okay, they're heading home. And then I'm with you now. Again, it's okay to go anytime you want. And then Sakum's going to show up at 9, and then she'll be with you through the night, and then we'll all be here tomorrow. So basically about 2 hours later, he went into aptic breathing, and that was it. And I sat with him and told him again, it's okay to go. You know, I love you. It's okay to go. And he went. And then I learned the next day when I got down there that they had driven home and got home. Kelly did a couple of things, got comfortable, and then they all met in the living room. And right when they sat down, like that minute was right when I called Kelly to let her know that Dwayne had passed. So, you know, no coincidences. And, you know, it was a great, great honor for me to do that. And it was also very, very clear, like, it was time to let go. And it was time to help him let go, you know? And I feel like it was this deep, very, very personal experience for me of where we are on the planet. And it really brought down the climate crisis for me on to a level that made it that much more real that, you know, right now we're losing 200 species a day, and this is only going to accelerate. You know, the report comes out, earlier this week, that the U.S. has lost something like a third or a quarter of its bird population.
I think it was like 3 billion birds have disappeared in the past several decades. So, yeah.
Right. So we're staring it in the face. You know, I mean, these reports are coming out every other day now, and it's so I got to do that with my best friend, but, you know, if we're going to be less human supremacists and just look at these other species, then, you know, we're getting to do this every day now if we really look closely enough and take in what this means, as well as from where things are looking today with all my analysis and everything I've learned from my climate reporting, it's really hard to see how humans make it through this. I mean, I'm not saying that's a guarantee, but it's really hard to see that humans make it through this. And I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we all get to get our head around. And so it comes down to how then shall we live? You know, how are we going to use this time? We're still here. We all still have work to do. And how are we going to use that time? And to me now, that is more in focus than it's just ever been my entire life. Like, okay, you know, how am I going to use this time? How am I going to employ the things I've learned from my friend and from that experience of helping him die?
Thank you for sharing that. Barbara, did you have any thoughts on that at all? Anything that came up when he shared that?
I think I'm just into listening. Okay. And I can appreciate really deeply both just where I've had the privilege of walking with Dar in this particular passage, and I appreciate the depths to which he's dropped in himself. And a kind of wisdom that's rising in the space of the grief. And
Can I ask something? Because I think that people are afraid of the wisdom that can arise from the grief. Don't you think there's something about the denial of accepting the grieving process, letting it come in? And that does tie to the climate movement or the sort of activism that sprung up around climate change. In a sense, there isn't room for grief. It's all about action.
Right. Yeah. The underneath, there's this fear that if you go into the grief, you're going to get stuck.
Yeah.
That there's nothing on the other side of it. And I think it's really important, probably the greatest service that many of us can provide at this time, that have a rich experience of life and having actually gone through endings and let themselves feel them and feel the phase after that, that there's a, provide reassurance to those that are terrified of admitting where we are because they're terrified of the feelings.
Yeah.
And I feel like my service at this particular time is be in a basket or a place of sanctuary and reassurance that for people who are out there doing every possible thing they can with their lives on the line, knowing that they're going to hit a wall. Yeah. And that the realization that this is too little, too late, incremental change isn't going to do it. Political action in the way they've seen it isn't going to do it. And when you hit the reality of that, there's usually some level of depression. Yeah. And that's when we really need one another. That's when our spiritual fiber is needed. And that's where some level of just real living, everything is not important, drops away. Mm-hmm. There's a quality of intimacy and love between people with the earth that begins to show itself amidst the waves of realization and the continual continue as the news comes in. I mean, it's not like you go through grief once.
Yeah.
It's like this is an iterative process if you pay attention at all. And there's a kindness and a understanding and a beauty in the intimacy that's possible here.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, some level of fulfillment, because instead of just doing this and fixing that and flexing our muscles, there's a quality of listening and being that starts coming into the picture, where a deeper part of our nature begins to come out. And I believe that part of our nature is rests more easily in the web of life, that our mental supremacy begins to fade as we realize that we can't think our way out of this or act our way out of this. A humility begins to set in, and then there's some sense of a new kind of belonging and a new sense of time and a new sense of connection to ancestors and a new experience of what it means to be human.
So there's something on the other side of grief. There's something that comes out of that that's extremely necessary and valuable in the time that we're in.
That's my experience.
It's your experience. Okay. Have either of you two seen the film My Dinner with Andre? Is that ever,
oh,
have you
seen? I remember it very well.
it's just a film between two old friends sitting in a dinner, having dinner in a restaurant in New York, and they're just talking about their life experiences, and it's really profound. But one of the characters, Andre, he's grieving at this point in his life. He's explaining it. I think his similar thing where his father or mother is in a hospital and they're dying, and describes the doctor coming in and looking at him and just saying, oh yeah, looks like they're healing up just fine. And the doctor was unable to see the patient as somebody that was dying. That was so obvious to the family. Everybody that was really seeing, really listening, really present could see that this person was dying. And Andre said something like, that is something like that doctor is a butcher. He's a murderer. Because what he came in is he just tried to impose this false worldview on everybody, that everything is fine, everything's going according to plan, and that this person is healing up, when it was so apparent and obvious to everybody in the room that that is not the case. And he was just, in that part of the film, he's speaking, he's like viscerally angry thinking about it and talking about going out in the world, being very raw, and everyone's having to chit-chat with him. They're just not seeing him as he really is, till finally somebody sees him. It's like, oh my God, what happened? And he says, oh, my grandmother died, or however it was. And he says, she was the only person that could really see me, because she herself was also in a state of grief for some other reason and had experienced that. And so I think I want to talk a bit about, because today there's been these massive climate marches, climate strikes happening today, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe even
millions,
right, around the world in different cities are protesting, demanding some sort of change, whatever that is. And I would like, maybe, Dar, if you could speak to that. It's beautiful in a certain way, but there is something like a denial. And I think what I wanted to bring up, however much you wanted to express this side of yourself, but coming out against the hopers, coming out against the people that are really trying to put, like I described that doctor as the butcher, you know, putting the veil over everything and saying, no, we still have time. We still have time. Keep on pushing harder. Keep on pushing harder. And we'll save the world. What do you think about that?
I have a lot of thoughts about that. In that, what you shared about my dinner with Andre was extremely poignant, because that's what I just experienced. I mean, there was a point when it was clear that my friend Dwayne was gone. It was just a matter of time and helping his body let go. And yet the doctor would walk into the ICU and, okay, we're going to do this now. And I just had this sudden realization, like looking at this guy, you know, knowing that he had cancer all in his body and had just come out of this intensely traumatic surgery. And the dog's weighing in on
dog
this.
Dog is sneezing. Yes, it's sneezing.
It's, and then them coming in and treating him just like, oh, okay, we're going to do this now, and then we're going to do this, and then tomorrow, if that doesn't work out, we can do this. And I had this sudden realization. They're just treating him like a piece of meat, you know, like not that he's human, not factoring in his age and what he's already been through and what this means and what this means for the people that love him. And it was just all about keep him alive no matter what, you know, even if it's just for another day. And without really appreciating the magnitude of the situation, which is, no, this is his last stage. Like, this is this rare, precious time where we're going to have these experiences and come out of it with this new wisdom that Barbara just talked about. And just missing that whole thing because, oh, we're hell-bent. We're going to use Western medicine and we're going to do this technique that next and then this and this drug and, you know. And you miss the whole thing. You miss the whole point. And for me, having just hung up really my journalism saddle and knowing like I've contributed what I can with this book, and I feel like it's a book that will become even more pertinent with time. And that I have nothing left to say. And I understand deeply in my body what it means to be on a planet where the life support systems of the planet are dying. And while they're dying, they're, what's left of them are being killed off as fast as possible by global governments. Mm-hmm. And then we have, I think, the majority of the people, even in the climate movement, that don't really understand that and don't really get what it means. Because for those that don't really get it and still think, oh, the Green New Deal, you know, Naomi Klein's book just came out. And it's basically, they, you still see this lingo like save the planet, or we still have 10 years or 11 years. And you have to have hope. And I've literally had conversations with people that understand what's going on, but then say, no, you can't just give people this hard information because they'll lose hope. Mm-hmm. And to me, as a journalist and as a writer and as a truth teller, that's the antithesis of everything that I'm about. It's completely unethical and immoral. I mean, to me, it'd be like going up to my friend Dwayne and saying, no, you don't. Okay, you have you might have stage 4 cancer, but like there's this and this and this, and you're going to be just fine. Or in the analogy I just used with some of the folks in the climate movement, not even telling them that they have stage 4 cancer. You know, if you were a doctor, you'd be buried in lawsuits. Like you wouldn't be a doctor for long if that was going to be your approach. And yet we have people in the climate movement that are making a killing selling hope. And I think it's the worst kind of snake oil at this point. And it's robbing people of the deep experience of to really understand the gravity of the moment and then let that inform whatever actions they're going to take. Because if it was done in that proper context, these marches in the climate strike and the students and what they're doing today is magnificent and it's beautiful and it's powerful. And it's, hey, these kids, these people are wanting to go out on their feet. You know, they're going to be able to look back at this and say, yeah, we knew this was going on and this is what we did. And we did it because we knew that things were probably already all lost. And we did it anyway, because it's the right thing to do. I mean, that is the height of morality. That is the height of dignity and integrity. Instead of how many of these kids are doing it because they think, oh, there's still 10 years because Naomi Klein said so, or there's still the Green New Deal. And there's still hope, when the Green New Deal is just capitalism with a green leaf on it, which is still the system that's brought us to this point of extinction. So there's this huge divergence, really, a philosophical and perceptual difference that's amazing to be on one side of it and looking at the other side of it. And they might feel as amazed, you know, and so I get accused of being a doomer when all I've done is tell the truth. And there's 21 pages of citations in my book, but how many times has the kill the messenger onslaught been at my doorstep when all I'm doing is citing scientists and scientific studies? And it's just, that's the reaction that one gets when you try to tell the truth amidst a climate, a political climate in this country and on the left of a soft denialism. But I think what's at stake is literally, you know, are you going to be honest with people and let them have the experience and make the choices that we each get to make, staring death in the face, and then deciding from that point, honestly, how do we want to live our lives? And I'm going on a little bit here, but I don't want to leave anything out. You know, another analogy that I've used is, you know, I've worked as a guide up on Denali. And it'd be like if I had a crew of people that I was responsible for being at high camp at 17,200 feet on Denali, and then getting the nightly weather report from NOAA that says, hey, we've got the biggest storm in history ever coming. We've never seen a storm like this. It's coming so fast, you guys can't descend. So you're there. So do what you need to do. And then me, I get a choice, right? So if I'm going to be peddling snake oil and false hope, maybe I wouldn't tell people this big storm's coming. Or maybe I would say, hey, this storm's coming, but I think we're going to be okay if we do X, Y, and Z. You know, if we change a few things, we do a few things differently. Or would it be more responsible for me to say, just point blank, okay, here's what I know, here's what I was just told, NOAA just said the biggest storm ever off all the charts is coming. So here's what we're going to do. I don't know about you guys, but let's give it a go and see if we can make it through this. So you're going to, you, Patrick, you're going to start reinforcing snow walls. Barbara, you're going to double pull the tents. So-and-so over here is going to check our provisions, and we're going to hunker in, and we're going to get really dialed in, and then we're going to sit and enjoy and appreciate each other's company and get ready for what's coming. I mean, that's what I hope would be the scenario, you know, that everybody would take. And then I think, you know, that's what's upon us. And I could keep going on this. And it's a very, very important question, but I think I've spoken long enough.
Well, Barbara, you know, the first week I was here, we were talking about this article that came out right around when I arrived, which was published in The New Yorker by Jonathan Franzen, who's a novelist. What If We Stop Pretending? And it's about the climate apocalypse. And something we talked about was more of the, we didn't find much fault in the article and its conclusions. But speaking to those that peddle hope, their reaction was immediate and it was fierce. I mean, they were like, how dare you use your huge platform to tell us that we have no hope? You know, that, you know, it's, we're already in this runaway climate change situation. The clampdown or the reaction was massive and very, very fast. And I mean, what did that speak to you about the state of maybe not just activism, but just the general populations, the soft denialism that Dar spoke to? I mean, it's on the left where, they accept the science of climate change up to a point, right? Because they say, you know, if you see any of the major climate activists out there, if it's a Naomi Klein or whoever, you know, trust the science, always bringing that point up. And I'm like, well, practice what you preach. Science is showing that, you know, Dar, you said this in an interview just the other day, we have 3 degrees of warming baked in right now. And I mean, what kind of planet is that going to be for us as a species or other life on this planet? I mean, and that's going to happen regardless of what we do. So yeah, I mean, you know, the responsibility, if you want to speak to that, that some of these people have to be honest and speak to the truth of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, speaking about that article and the reactions, I was more interested in the intensity and the timing of the reactions than the content of the reactions. Yeah. Because it was like a microcosm of what happens. Some kind of terror about actually taking in what the guy said and listening to what was underneath it. There was very little space to consider it, to reflect on why it pushed my button so badly. Like, what is it in me that just went crazy listening to this thing? So the space to actually digest and consider and to open to something was foreclosed so bloody fast by most people. Mm-hmm. And many people who were peddling hope, as Dar's described so, I think, so articulately. So, I think it's a way of being that refuses to live in the spaces that is so addicted to taking action and to fixing things that there isn't any space to let go, to release a lot of the beliefs that we have, a lot of the assumptions that we have about living, to go down, to appreciate the dark, to encounter uncertainty, to grow up.
Mm-hmm. Grow up, yeah.
And live from a different place in ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that speaks to when you talk about the how quickly the reactions were to that. I think speaks to what you're saying about finding those spaces in between, analyzing or trying to really feel what's being triggered in people, right? What is that speaking to?
Well, I know what I'm craving right now is space to feel and think together. People, I don't, I just know that I have this great big aversion to words right now. And sometimes I can't find my own.
And here you are talking with us.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And I had some resistance to even doing this because I just get sick of this big, long spew of what, you know, people's opinions. Okay, here's your opinion. Here's your opinion. Here's your opinion. And it's dizzy making. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it's just about ego, and it's a lot of it's about winning. And I want to sit down at the dinner table and pray together. I want to give thanks together. I want to go quiet. I want to hear what's going on in the depths of your heart. I want to make space for me to change, for me to be wrong, for me to feel. And all of that requires a different kind of pacing. And, you know, serial sound bites, the onslaught of news, we're trained into a loss of personal authority. I mean, at the very worst of the whole thing, I mean, we have this authoritarian fascist authoritarian wave running through the world. And for me, the question really comes is, we're going to be subject to everything on the outside of us unless we hit our own authority. Unless these kind of spaces are opened in our conversations, in our spiritual practices, in the way we live our lives, where a different level of knowing comes.
Mm.
And that's the opportunity of this time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, if there's, I sometimes I try to not give what we're going through collectively an intelligence, you know, to say that climate catastrophe, ecological disintegration, social unrest, everything that's coming and is currently manifesting, I don't always want to just give it some sort of life in and of itself, as if this force is asking something of us. Because I think we're a meaning generating species, and we use narratives to explain ourselves to us. But if this were to speak to something, if we were to find meaning, you know, as your subtitle of your book is, you know, finding meaning in the path of climate disruption, Dar, you know, what is that meaning? I mean, what is it really speaking to here? And I mean, a lot of it to me often can be framed in a very cynical or negative way, which may serve a certain purpose up to a point. But I think, as you're saying, Barbara, like, getting to that deep place, and it's asking us to accept something. And I mean, what in your explorations in the subject, what is this crisis or these crises asking of us?
That's a huge question. It's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bring it back to what I just went through with my friend Dwayne, which is, at the end of the day, when all is lost and there's nothing left, I mean, it comes down to, I love this guy, and I'm going to be there and be as present with him as I know how to be. And the intensity of presence that I experienced because of how much I love him, that those last days, like, I'm still recovering. Like, I slept 11 hours last night and I'm still tired. I mean, the intensity of presence that I bestowed upon him, just being there with him and for him, was a real gift. And I've never experienced anything like that. And it comes down to love. It's, I love him. He's going to be gone any minute now. And so I am going to just be there with him as fully with every cell of my being as I can. And it comes down to love and service. And it's that way now with the planet. I mean, in the wake of his passing, I already knew this intellectually before that happened, but now I know in my heart that why is it that I almost have this compulsion to just be out in the mountains as much as I can? And it's because I love, that's my favorite part of nature, and I love it, and I want to be out in it as much as I can, because I know that these glaciers that I see when I go into the Olympics or the Cascades are going to be gone, many of them within my lifetime, all of them probably before 2100, but they're still here. So I want to go appreciate them and be with them and marvel at them and have awe when I look at them, you know. And it's because I love them and I love that part of the earth, and it's the same thing. And so I think the, you know, the bearing witness part of my subtitle comes from, it is our moral responsibility to bear witness to these things as they're going away, because that's a way to love them. And then the finding meaning part comes in, how can I still be of service while they're still here? And then after they're gone, how can I still be of service? You know, because it comes down to, you know, I've had different things come up for me in the wake of my friend's death, and I've struggled with a couple of them, and, you know, some regrets and some what maybe I should have done this differently, and oh, but I didn't do that. And so I was talking with, you know, I've had some great conversations with Barbara about it that have helped a lot, and some other friends. And then one that I had with our mutual friend, Stan Rushworth, who you're definitely going to have on this podcast, an elder of Cherokee descent. And he just confirmed, he's like, no, you were there. You gave him your utter, complete, perfect presence. And that's, there's nothing else you can do beyond that. And then he said, the other thing he said that really helped a lot was, you know, all this other stuff, you know, that, and he wasn't talking just about Dwayne, but just about, you know, all this other stuff that people do, and everything else that we do in our lives and the fights that we get into and the disagreements and opinions and all that. And he's just like, you know, man, that's all just a bunch of fucking horse shit. Because when you get all the way down to it, the only thing that matters is how we're going to treat each other. Are we going to treat each other well? Are we going to be kind to each other and love each other or not? Because all that other stuff's just bullshit and digressions and a complete, utter waste of time. Because if you're living your life the right way, it's all going to come all the way down to, you know, how can I be a better person? And that means, how can I treat other people better?
Mm-hmm. But that reminds me of a line from Joanna Macy. What did she say about that? What was her, the culmination of her work was?
Yeah, she was asked in a really poignant interview quite a ways back, so Joanna, why do you keep doing this work? And she said, I do this work so that when things fall apart, we won't turn against each other.
Hmm. Yeah. Do you have anything, Barbara? I feel like you write notes while Dar's talking. I feel like you're going to have something to say, but not necessarily.
I think Dar's cutting to the chase, and there are some things to do in this time, in this window. Mm-hmm. When you ask about meaning, I think each person will find, if they're really listening, what's theirs to heal, to restore, to remember, so that they can get down to this core truth of themselves. And I know for me of late, I'm glad that Dar brought Stan up, because there's something to reckon with about how we got here. Mm-hmm. There's some need in me to take some ownership of what's happened in the past, where this deep separation from this true, deep, real self that Dar's talking about happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the work of this time. Because I don't believe we're at the apex of civilization. I think we've fallen to this level. I think a lot of this is a big mistake, not some wondrous manifestation of great human accomplishment. But it's what's happening now is because of the seeds that were planted historically. And the work and the muscle that's needed from some people is to look it square in the face about what happened in this country. Mm-hmm. This country was built on genocide. There, in the history of California, there were 16,000 Native Americans that were deliberately killed, who were in the way of the gold rush and the settlement from the white people that wanted to come in and claim the paradise that had been there for 15,000 years under the, you know, under the care and of the Native Americans there. So something went awry. And part of bringing something back into balance ourselves and in our relationship to this earth is to see what we did. Mm-hmm. And to understand how the greed and the control and the need for security is endemic in my own thinking. Mm-hmm. I learned it in my own education. I mean, it's so everywhere. And beginning to find some perspective on all of that feels really important when you ask, where's the meaning in this time?
Yeah, I feel that completely as well. And I've tried my best to explore that in my own way as well. Yeah. You want to say something, Dar?
Just continuing on the track that Barbara was just on, you know, and I conclude my book talking about this, and it's something that I was reminded of from Stan, the elder that I mentioned earlier, was, you know, the importance of listening. And the three of us have been talking, this has been like one of the themes of conversation that we've all been having since you've been up here, Patrick, and that I learned through working with Stan that the reason I've always gone into the mountains is because that's where I go to listen. Because that's where I go, I get quiet and I get humbled and I have awe of what's around me and I know my place in the world, and then I'm able to listen. And it's because when I'm up there, it's very easy for me to comport myself the right way. It's like you're going to have proper respect or you're going to pay for it dearly really quick. You know, if you go out ill-prepared, if you try to go up something you're not prepared for, et cetera, in the mountains. And so I listen. And one of the things that I've been talking about in my book talks and then sometimes in interviews is that, you know, people are, what do we do? What should we do? You know, and it's one part of the whole climate mobilization that I think is part of the dinosaur that Barbara just alluded to, and kind of part of this hierarchical, patriarchal system of having someone else tell us what to do, needing to have a leader, when right now all systems have failed. all systems have failed. All systems being colonial settler, global capitalist, control over, are being separated from the earth systems. I mean, just the hubris and the sheer arrogance in that statement, how we can still save the earth, mm-hmm. is repulsive.
And I think what they're saying isn't the earth. They're talking about our civilization.
They
and,
are.
And capitalism.
To be more specific, yes.
Yeah.
And so what I've learned is when you really listen, and I mean go really quiet, put all the mental jargon aside and just get really quiet and really, really humble and really listen to the earth, then I believe that each one of us is going to get our own personal walking orders, marching orders of, okay, here's what you're going to do. Here's what I need you to do. And that's where I've gotten my messages to go to Iraq, to do the book that I did with The End of Ice and so many other big decisions in my life and small ones. When I go out there, I listen and I get this clear message and I always know what to do. And I really believe that now is that time for people to, you know, don't run around in panic. Don't light your hair on fire. Don't go out and see what other 10 more things you can do or how many articles you can forward and all this, but just stop and get really, really quiet and touch down into the earth and really listen and see what comes up into your heart when you ask, what is it that I need to do to really serve this planet? Because I think if we do that, and in the proper context of understanding that it is too late, you're not going to get all that heat out of the oceans. The oceans have absorbed 93% of the heat we've put into the atmosphere. I mean, that heat is staying there and it's increasing and it's not going to go away. We're not going to turn this thing around. And so in the context of knowing the great loss that's now upon us, what is the most important thing for me to do? And for some people, it might be, I need to play music. And that's great because God knows we need music right now. And for some people, it might mean I'm going to write a book. And for some people, it might mean, you know, Barbara and I's good friend, Colin McIntosh, he just went and got arrested and he's in Extinction Rebellion. All power to him. You know, to other people, it might mean we're going to go shut this fucking shit down once and for all. Great. Please do. You know, but my point is that if you really listen in closely and get that call for you to do and understand that it's in the context that we really have nothing left to lose, I would argue that that's going to generate an activism and actions taken from love that could never happen in the context of this, oh, do this because this book tells you to do it, or go to this march because we're organizing it and we have a permit, or go on this date, we're going to do this. I'm talking about doing things way more radical and way further outside of the box than a lot of this stuff that we see happening right now. I'm talking about real risk.
I am on board.
Yeah, well, just to say, the other day we were talking and what was the one-liner that we came up that hope was fundamentally an avoidance of an essential risk that needs to be taken. Mm. Yeah. And that risk is different for every person. But the hope occludes the radical act of love, of choice, of being sourced from within to do something that may not fit at all. And in that case, I think the sum total of a lot of radical acts of risk is pretty spectacular. Could be.
Can you talk? I mean, I think this is an idea that's going to be pretty different and new for a lot of people. I mean, can you maybe talk a bit more about how does having hope occlude risk, or how does it stand in the way? I mean, can you just unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah, it's a foreign idea for many people. They see hope as being a facilitator for right action and from a good place, and, you know, having optimism is always the right way to go. How does it occlude what you're discussing? Yeah.
Okay, now I have to think for a second. So this is...
No, so I think the theme of this has been pauses, taking moments to listen.
Yeah.
So take as long as you need.
I know that we're onto something because I'm sweating. I can tell you that right off the bat, that my hands are just absolutely soaked and freezing.
If I was filming this, you'd just see Barbara just drenched in sweat right now. It would just be pouring out of her.
It's a sweatband.
Yeah.
This is a sport. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking out the window right now and aware that there is a young man that has left his career as a librarian at California State Sonoma, I believe.
Sonoma State University.
Sonoma State University. He was... he had a very good job. His mother was a librarian, so he was like really cool with his family. And he came to a point where it was unbearable, the politics in the situation and the fit for his spirit and the misfit of focus for this time. Mm-hmm. And he picked up with his partner and moved up here and decided to, is living in a, what looks like a Civil War tent that they have kitted out with a stove. They're going to weather the winter in it, and he is learning permaculture. Mm-hmm. Not everybody needs to take this risk. Not everybody can take this risk, but I have a feeling there's a risk for everyone. Because business as usual has gotten us into the mess that we're in. And if hope somehow relates in any way to the continuance of business as usual, we will not see the risks that we need to take to change course. Mm-hmm. Because this, where we are, is... I don't believe that it is an expression of the true human spirit. Like, somewhere we diverted. Mm-hmm. And to get back on track means following some other kind of impulse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what comes right now. There will probably be more here in a second, but I'm waiting for it.
Yeah. That's good. Did you have anything else to add? You seem like you're very pensive. You look like you're about to, or pensive.
Well, I think this is what happens to me a lot, is that there's something that's under the surface. Mm-hmm. And I can feel it, but my mind doesn't get it. So that's happening to me right now. So I know it's time to listen.
Yeah.
Until it gets all the way up here. Mm-hmm. And it's hard in these times to live in a void when you don't know what to do and you don't know what to say, because whatever it is isn't all the way up on the surface yet. And that's a risk to not have the answer.
Well, I think our culture's obsessed with having answers, you know, for everything. And we're very uncomfortable in a general sense. It's something we've had this conversation with numerous people throughout the week of unlearning what we have learned. We spend maybe 13 or more years in public schooling and college and that whole drawn out education process. And then once you get into a space like many people we're meeting that are wanting to take a risk and that know deeply they have to, that risk includes deprogramming yourself from the cultural conditioning that we've been, you know, awashed in. And our media is just reinforcing it constantly, constantly, constantly. So it's no surprise that young people are, of course, acting from that place. Not that it's not beautiful or worth whatever, but they're acting from that place of action because there has to be a solution and they're being told there's a solution. So there's never going to be a space open for them to really begin to ask those questions, or most of them at least, that are
so
required.
So I have a member of my family who is she's 17 years old, and she's really smart, and she's been set up to go to any college that she wants to in the whole country. And she has had the gumption to say, I'm taking a year off. That real education is going to take place for me in an entirely different way. I'm going the vocational route. I am going to learn practical skills that will help me to thrive and to help other people in the times that are coming. So she's learning about timber frame building. She's learning about horticulture. She's learning about welding. She's learning about electrical, whatever you call it. Mm-hmm. And that's her risk, is to just be different and to follow follow a thread that's hers, and that was not that was very different from the educational track that most young people are on. Not all people are on the track to go to college. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying there's it takes a risk to go your own way.
It does, yeah.
And I think that for young people right now, that is a huge thing, because our institutions are not preparing people for what's to come. And a lot of young people know that. And so there's a huge revolution needed here in supporting young people for what they're going to face, what we've landed them with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think in your last piece that you both did for Truth Out, Dar, at the beginning, you talk about that you half joke with friends about living in the apocalypse, which is very true. You do half joke about living in the apocalypse quite often, but but you're really, what you're saying here is that you're kind of hearkening to the Greek root of that word, which means literally uncovering, disclosure, and revelation. And this, to me, what this crisis has always presented to me was like, this is the truth about, I mean, this is always going to happen. If we were going to live in this way, this is what inevitably would come from that. And you've talked about people that have encountered the white people for the first time, white men, seeing how rapacious they are, how greedy and unyielding they are in their just swallowing up the earth. And I think we were talking about indigenous prophecies and how, you don't have to be a prophet. You don't have to have some mystical, skill to see into the future and see where this is going to lead. You don't have to be a scientist. You just have to, you could just look at the way people were landing on this land and see, okay, well, this is the inevitable conclusion of this. And they were already sensing that because they were listening and they were seeing it for what it was, even before it became to a tipping point, which is where we've already crossed.
That's exactly right, and that's one of the things we've been talking about since you've been here is, Native American scholar Jack Forbes, who wrote a book called Columbus and Other Cannibals, which should be mandatory reading, especially in this country. But he talks about that Wetiko disease, which is what essentially settler colonialism is, which is, if you have it, it's a psychosis, and it means you think that it's okay to take another person's resources or life for your own benefit. And that's what settler colonialism / global capitalism is, even capitalism with a green leaf, because it means you're taking things from the earth. Of course, people like to call those resources, mm-hmm. but you're taking things from the earth, you're killing parts of the earth in order for your own benefit, and somehow that's okay. And so, right, from an indigenous perspective of, oh, hey, these all these white folks showed up and they're completely insane because they think they can do all this and it's okay. And they have the biggest guns and they're going to get away with it and they're going to just keep doing it and probably figure out faster ways to do it and more efficient ways to do it. And so how is this going to end? And so hence the, as you said, the prophecies are very, it's just logic. You know, it's just like, let's run this out to its logical conclusion. And now we are, we being now people living in the end of industrial growth culture where the reckoning is now upon us, not just indigenous people, but everyone, even those that have caused it. The reckoning is upon all of us. And you know, the, even the rich people, your money's not going to protect you.
Yeah, it's funny. I interviewed Douglas Rushkoff earlier this year or last year. He had a piece come out called Survival of the Rich, or The Survival of the Richest, and he just talked about that, this sort of huge disconnect that the wealthy have, where they think that they can build these elaborate, very expensive, but elaborate bunkers in some part of the world, and that somehow through their wealth and power that they have right now, that they're going to somehow weather the storm, and that they're going to have all the supplies they need.
And it's just another form of denialism.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've spoken a lot during this program about just all these different forms of denialism. We don't even need to waste a breath on the denialism of the right and the fossil fuel industry, but then the soft denialism on the left. And there's all these iterations, and all of it comes down to some form of hope. There's some form of hope that's consistent in all of those that's going to prevent all of those people from taking the real risk, which is ultimately looking deep, deep, deep inside of each of ourselves and then trying to decide, okay, what is it now that I most need to do more than anything else in the world, given that we have this extremely finite amount of time left? And it means, yes, considering our own deaths.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Enjoy my bones. When I die, let me go. When I die, let the wolves enjoy my bones. When I die, let me go.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, and you can treat that like a bit of a tip jar. If you like this episode, or any other episode of this podcast in particular, consider throwing a few bucks Patrick's way. That would really be helpful. And if you would really like to sustain this work and support this project more regularly, consider supporting this project through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness and donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month, And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release. And you will also gain access to some exclusive content there as well. As the great psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, "Take it easy, dude, but take it."